You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, August 20th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, senior editor with the New Republic, Julia Ioffe, on all things Russian, including their draconian laws making the gay illegal. Also on the program, the wake of the NSA leaks. The leaks themselves continue. The Guardian, on the same day it was, the day after Glenn Greenwald's partner detained for 9 hours in Heathrow, The Guardian reports that the British government made it smash its computers. Meanwhile, the establishment still with a problem with this whistleblowing, Jeffrey Toobin, sort of just an astounding piece, determined to join the bandwagon to discover this type of whistleblowing. The CIA finally admits, which many had largely known, its role in the Iranian coup that brought the Shah to power. In Egypt, more violence. The United States says it will withhold some funding, perhaps temporarily. We shall see. A fast food strike is announced, will happen in 9 days from today. Ted Cruz renounces the best part of himself. Bloomberg admits that maybe if he had some skin in the game, literally, he might be against stop and frisk. But he doesn't, so he's not. What are you going to do?
Having a watch.
Last night, I was in New York City and emceed a fundraiser for the legal defense funds of Barrett Brown and Jeremy Hammond. We haven't covered their cases too much. Barrett Brown is now, I think, on the cover of Rolling Stone, of this issue. Barrett Brown, a journalist and activist, he started Project PM. He is in jail. It's not quite clear, but he is charged with three counts, one involving pasting a link to the Stratfor hack on a chat board, the other for, I guess, a threatening YouTube toward an FBI agent who had threatened his mom. Jeremy Hammond is in prison for the Stratfor hack, but clearly another case of prosecutorial overreach, particularly when it deals with the CFAA. Go back and listen to Matt's interview with Tor Eklund to get more information on that. Tor Eklund, one of the speakers there, Marty Lederman, Michael Ratner, Greg Hausch, Stanley Cohen, Kevin Gallagher, who is running that the Barrett Brown support organization. We will play audio from last night sometime next week. We're going to be off next week. Yes, I know. But we will endeavor to have some new material, but it'll be mostly best of next week, I believe. And then come fall, we will be back to our regularly scheduled programming. I will have exited the sort of post-paternity leave phase of my life with my new child. And all shall be back to normal. And in that week, first week in September, maybe the second week, we will release our apps, which are getting great reviews from all of our beta testers. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Julia Yaffe. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Julia Yaffe. She is the senior editor at, or a senior editor, I should say, at the New Republic. Welcome to the program, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
You have a really a tough piece in the New Republic about stories of being gay in the new Russia. We have a link to that piece on majority.fm. People can go and check out the specific stories, but it really paints a picture of a society that is being incredibly hostile to gay people. To outline for us first the laws that have been passed over the past year, essentially making gay people second-class citizens and even sort of discussing gay people illegal.
So the main law is the anti-gay propaganda law, and what it does is it's purposely pretty vaguely written, but it prohibits propaganda, so discussing, and not, it's not clear publicly or not, discussing homosexuality, saying that homosexuality is normal, saying that homosexual relationships are on par with heterosexual relationships. And Russians who are found guilty of this law, of violating this law, are punishable with pretty stiff penalties, monetary penalties, whereas foreigners face the threat of a jail term for about 2 weeks in jail. There have also been laws banning the adoption of Russian children by gay couples and banning adoption to countries where they're where same-sex marriages have been legalized, which, given that Russia has nearly a million orphans and has more orphans now than it had at the end of the Second World War when the country lost 27 million people, is, you know, I don't know that they're in a position to be ruling out, you know, who can and can't adopt Russian kids. So the problem with the anti-gay propaganda log is, I don't know if it comes across in my piece, but Russia is where the U.S. was, you know, 40 years ago, where people generally didn't understand what homosexuality is. They think it's either a choice or a psychiatric or psychological aberration. And here in the U.S., not only was this process kind of undone by an active and well-organized gay activist community, but also by people coming out. And, you know, it's a lot harder to hate somebody specific that you know, as opposed to, you know, an abstract, nebulous group, a representative whom you haven't ever met. The problem with this law is it criminalizes, essentially, the process of coming out and makes normalization of homosexuality a lot more difficult, which is its intent.
I want to just go back. I mean, I want to pick up on that point. But according to that law, is it that it will not allow adoption of Russian kids to countries that accept or recognize gay marriage? Does that mean that United States?
The U.S. is a separate issue. The U.S., they banned adoptions by Americans a while ago as retaliation for a law that was passed in Congress that blocked Russian human rights violators from entering the U.S. and freezing their assets. So the way the Russians retaliated was very strangely. It was very strange. They went after their own orphans.
Weird. That's
a separate issue. Yeah.
And is it the case that also that my understanding is that gay couples in Russia cannot have custody of children, even if the child is a biological child of one of the parents?
Well, this is a law being discussed now in the Russian parliament about taking children from. From gay households. We don't know if that's going to pass. There's a lot of these strange laws being discussed. The woman who, the parliamentarian who proposed initially and sponsored a lot of this anti-gay legislation has also been behind some rather ridiculous, very traditionalist proposals like banning cursing on the internet, banning discussions of oral sex. Like it's this weird grasping for some kind of traditionalist conservative model of a Russia that never really existed, but you know, this like fairy tale Russia of yore. It's very, you know, what I feel like a lot of conservatives all over the world would like to do, but they're usually hemmed in by you know, competitive forces. They have a signal from the top from Putin that this is okay, and you know, they're getting innovative.
So I get, you know, conceptually that Russia is you know, where this country was 40 years ago, but I mean, where were they 10 years ago? In other words, I mean, why are we seeing these laws now as opposed to them having always been on the books?
Well, homosexuality was criminalized until 1993. It was criminalized in the Soviet Union, and in 1993 that was repealed. If you look at polls of Russians, they're actually quite interesting. So 10 years ago, people thought about the same thing about homosexuality. About 74% of Russians think that it's an aberration in one way or another. You know, the cause of the result of a bad upbringing, or you know, a psychiatric disease that must be treated. 10 years ago, people thought about the same thing, but the polls showed that people felt that gay people should be left alone. And when Russians were asked, you know, what would they do if somebody they knew, a relative or a friend or a colleague, came out to them, a majority said that they wouldn't react. They would react without emotion, as the questionnaire said. Today, that number has plummeted, and today people say things like they would seek medical help for them, they would try to force them to lead a heterosexual lifestyle, they would, you know, stop socializing with that person. And that's the result of the propaganda around the anti-gay propaganda law. So Russia was, you know, where we were 30, 40 years ago, and things were starting to get better. Like, I lived in Russia until last fall, and I had a lot of gay friends there, and things, especially in Moscow, especially in certain circles in Moscow, things were getting better. You know, people were coming out to their parents, their friends, and seeing that people didn't really care. Now it's gotten worse. It's just many steps back instead of going forward. And part of the reason is Russia is floundering. It is still in the grips of a demographic crisis. It's a shrinking, dying population. Putin is not seen in the cities as a legitimate leader, and he's trying to build a conservative constituency in the heartland again by harping on this. This conservative traditional Russia that never really existed. And also, you know, it's also a reaction to the West, to what's been happening in the West. The patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church came out and said that these laws were a direct response to laws in the West, in Europe and in America, that legalized gay relationships, and were which was in itself a sign of the apocalypse, as he said. So this is... you know, also part of Russia's traditional, very strange schizophrenic relationship with Europe and the West. On one hand, they want to be Western. They want to have a seat at the table in Europe. They want to be seen as an equal sparring partner with America. On the other hand, they want to hold on to their unique non-Western identity. And in this context, homosexuality has in the last, you know, 20 years since Russia opened up, to the West, which happened at the same time that homosexuality was decriminalized, and you know, people had never seen gays. People started to assume that homosexuality was an import from the West, that it was this kind of weird fashion choice that Russian kids were picking up from Western music videos, from Western movies and sitcoms and stuff. So this is kind of, it's seen as protecting a unique Russian identity against, you know, this hegemonic influence of the West, this corrosive moral and amoral influence.
So.
Sorry, that was a very rambling.
No, not at all. I mean, I think that, that largely answers my question. I mean, so to a certain extent, I mean, this raises a couple of things. One is that, that homosexuality, the idea of homosexuality and a certain amount of anti-West, or maybe we can see that as a nationalist, perspective, they're inexorable in some ways. I mean, is that right? So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, what part of this is a function of a sort of like Russia feeling, or the conservative body politic in Russia feeling there's a loss of Russian identity? What part of it is a function of something that is sort of exclusively problematic with homosexuality to the Russian psyche? And what part of it is being exploited by Putin? And
I think it's both. I think you know, polls show that Russians don't understand what homosexuality is. Like I said, in one way or another, 74% of Russians think that homosexuality is abnormal. The fact that it's being cynically exploited is a separate issue. I think you saw this in the U.S., for example, in the 2004 presidential election, where in order to consolidate a conservative base, George W. Bush played the gay marriage issue pretty hard and used it as a splinter issue to consolidate and rally a conservative base that may otherwise have stayed home during, you know, and voting for an incumbent. Right. Meanwhile, the country at the time was fighting two wars, it had tons of other problems, just like Russia has tons of other problems. Its oil and gas supplies are running out. Its population is shrinking. The corruption in Russia is at such a level that it's becoming necrotic. Society isn't really functioning. They have an illegitimate president that has lost the capital city as well as most of the middle class across the nation. They have tons of other problems, and precisely because of that, instead of dealing with them, it's a lot easier to just whip up some xenophobic sentiment in the heartland. They're doing something similar by rounding up migrants and putting them in these, rancid camps on the outskirts of Moscow. Also, this kind of nationalist xenophobic, rallying tool. So, yeah, it's all, I feel like people do this, leaders do this when they're feeling vulnerable, when they're feeling like they're losing their grip on power.
Right. And so what is the and certainly the idea of sort of the city versus the country is something that seems to play out, obviously, in mm-hmm. this country. You see it in even this is a dynamic that plays out in nation after nation. What is it? I mean, so to use that analogy of George Bush trying to drive people to the polls, the evangelical base to the polls by at one point he had announced, I think it was an evening press conference that he very sadly was going to have to support an amendment to the Constitution to basically say that gay people are second class citizens in this country. That was a strategy to drive people to the polls.
Mm-hmm.
How does, when Putin has to shore up his strength, what are the mechanics? I understand that this it consolidates his power in some respect, but mechanically, how does that work?
So what happens in Russia generally is Putin kind of gives a signal, in this case, that he would like to kind of whip up and solidify a conservative nationalistic base of support. And that signal filters down through the system, and actors on lower rungs of the pyramid, beneath him, or the power vertical beneath him, interpret it as they will. So people in the Duma, which is the Russian parliament, saw these laws working their way through the legislatures of smaller cities across Russia. This was weirdly a pretty grassroots law, and kind of took it up and passed it and kind of over-fulfilled their quota. It's like the good, the teacher's pet, the suck up in class trying to, do extra homework to please his teacher. That's what we're seeing. So we're seeing laws that I'm sure Putin thinks are ridiculous, but isn't about to stop them. These discussions of banning discussions of oral sex or banning curse words on the internet. It's just like, look, we're doing all these things to please you. Don't you like it? Isn't this what you wanted? Then one of the chunks of the system that takes up that signal is television. Television is still where most Russians get their information, and it's all controlled by the state. So you see a lot of, anti-Western, especially anti-American TV, a lot of anti-gay stuff on TV. You have a very prominent TV personality last spring coming out and saying on the biggest channel in Russia, saying that not only should we ban gay propaganda, but we should ban gays from being blood and organ donors. And not only should we ban them from being blood and organ donors, if a gay person dies in a car accident, we should take their hearts and bury them in the ground or burn them.
Jeez.
So, yeah, which is insane. But, and everybody in the audience just sits there stone-faced and then claps when he's done done with this tirade. But that's what happens, is that the system takes the signal and then runs with it and tries to, like, outdo each other. And what you get is these pretty absurd variations on a theme, which here is, you know, solidify this base of support in the heartland since we've lost the cities.
It sounds like almost like a combination of like the Alabama state legislature and Fox News in some respects,
that's
in terms
right.
of the way that these
right.
these signals are sent and what the motivations are behind them. I mean, so with that in mind, I mean, what does this tell us? I mean, I have two questions. What does this tell us about Putin or Russia in general? I mean, I guess you've maybe already answered this, but it sounds like Russia is at a crisis point, and Putin's aware of this, and it seems like a crisis that he cannot address. So here's the shiny objects.
That's right. Putin doesn't like addressing actual problems. He is not good at it. He is not a good strategic thinker. He thinks he's kind of a knee-jerk decision maker and thinks in the very short term. What he also likes to do is throw money at problems or it's a very Soviet attitude also to punish and ban, as opposed to, try to find innovative solutions to deal with what, you know, he perceives as problems. So instead of kind of dealing with what he sees as a demographic crisis or a crisis of legitimacy, he starts, you know, people start banning things, which, I mean, you see this all the time in Russia. If there's a disaster, you know, an industrial disaster, a natural disaster, the first thing the authorities do is open criminal cases.
Right.
So Putin, you know, he came to power. He went back for a third term, immediately lost cities, especially Moscow, which is still where he lives and works. He's completely lost Moscow. He was, I think, really shaken by the protests, where you had, 100,000 people coming out in the streets on the eve of his election and his inauguration. What he chose to do is he's not a very innovative guy sometimes. He went back to what he knows, which is turning inwards, playing the anti-American card, blaming the protests on the State Department, saying that all the people who had come out to protest him were paid for by the State Department. Turning inward, fanning these flames of anti-Americanism, being increasingly less cooperative with the Americans on the global stage, whereas before, you know, during Medvedev's tenure, things got done and there was a dialogue and there was a much more cooperative spirit. It's just this kind of, what he knows is the Cold War, and he's turning in on himself, but in this kind of, he's turning the country in on itself and isolating himself because he's not really good at finding other solutions. He's not an innovative thinker in that sense. He's knee-jerk. He's kind of cynical and thinks everybody else is too.
So when we see the reaction to these laws from an international perspective, I mean, they're really sort of I'm sure there are more, but there are two very prominent responses, at least from what we're seeing in this country. One has been the vodka boycott, and one has been mm-hmm. an attempt to pressure the IOC to move, to cancel and move the Olympics that are set to take place in Sochi, I think is how we pronounce it, in 2014. So give me your assessment of the relative value of those based upon, you know, and particularly from the perspective that the issue of the anti the homophobia, and I would say it almost goes beyond that, but how intertwined it is with this sort of anti-Western sentiment.
So I think it's the anti-gay stuff, the talk about the Olympics, the boycott, it's not getting all that much traction in Russia, in part because the activists pouring vodka into the gutters are pouring out, you know, Latvian-owned vodka or, you know, vodka that's produced here in the States. And it's never going to be enough to kind of make a huge dent in Russia's economy. Also, vodka is, you know, not even close to being Russia's most important export. Russia exports oil, gas, raw natural resources. Vodka is very, you know, very much at the bottom of the list. And it's probably seen as ridiculous inside the Kremlin. I think they also know that there's no chance that there's going to be a boycott of the Olympics, especially after Obama came out and said that was not going to happen, at least on the U.S. side. And that there's no chance that they'll be moved. And now, what it does is it creates an irritant around Putin's vanity project. He is obsessed with sports, in that he's a very Soviet person. He's obsessed with sports. He flew to the meeting of the International Olympic Committee in Central America to personally lobby the committee to get the Olympics in Sochi. It's very important to him. This was a huge victory for him, as was getting to host the World Cup in 2018. And, you know, this is probably quite annoying for him that his, you know, his moment, is being tarnished by by something that is seen in Russia as, you know, a global gay cabal. And, you know, they were trying to protect Russia from this global gay cabal. And here's the global gay cabal coming out and saying, you know, take our import. Let us in, you know, let us corrupt Russia. That's how it's seen in, I think, in Russia. I think Putin sees it a little bit more cynically. I don't think he's more homophobic than the average Russian. He probably never really thought about gay people before. He just kind of is happy to use this cynically as a wedge issue, the way George W. Bush did.
So in that respect,
he's probably just quite annoyed that they're, you know, messing his special moment.
So in that respect, it's at least having some minor impact, I guess, to that extent. Related to Putin's love of sports. Michael, my producer, has been reading a book where it tells a story that he took the man without a face, I guess. He took Bob Kraft's Super Bowl ring, the owner of the Patriots. Yeah. Are you aware of that story?
I don't think that's a sports thing. That's just like a prestigious bling thing. He just decided to, you know, it was a cool souvenir. It was blingy. It's clearly really valuable. And he was like, all right, thanks for the gift. And then what are you going to do? Say no, Mr. Putin, that wasn't a gift. He's right. Kind of terrifying. He's very short, but very terrifying.
Wow. That story is just amazing. Apparently, he basically just said to Bob Kraft when he was visiting, like, oh, Super Bowl ring. Can I see that? And they just pocketed it. What is that?
He supposedly said, "I could kill someone with this."
Well, it's a big ring.
I could just see him doing like an evil cackle after that.
Why is the idea that Russia could be in crisis? Why is that something that should be of concern to us in the United States beyond what has, obviously the import of Russia within the context of international relations? Why should that be a concern to us? And should it?
Because Russia has a huge stockpile of nuclear weapons, and again, they've recently backed out of any new weapons control measures that the Americans are proposing. And their way of, again, speaking of short-term thinking, they need to modernize their military, which is hopelessly behind the times. And what they're doing instead is just, modernizing their nuclear arsenal because that costs a little bit less. So, we don't want Russia to be a failed state that has a bunch of loose nukes floating around. It's also a major supplier of, it's recently surpassed Saudi Arabia as the largest exporter of oil. It's a big player in that world. And, it's the more Russia feels itself to be threatened and in crisis and disrespected, the more it starts sticking sticks in the wheels of American foreign policy and the more uncooperative they become. So, and that is a real concern as the Middle East kind of continues to explode.
And lastly, I want to touch on Snowden and just sort of give me your sense of how that played out. And at this point, it's necessary for me to say that I will not shout you down as we discuss this, despite mm-hmm. despite the fact that I have aspirations to go further in my career. But tell us, give us your sense of what of just how, it seems to me that in many respects Russia was got trapped into in the same way that Snowden got trapped in Russia got trapped with Snowden and by a set of circumstances. Just give me your sense of that.
So I think what happened is Snowden did a really poor job planning his escape. If I were him, I would have gone to Iceland and then released all of the stuff. But he also undermined his credibility by going to places like China and then Russia. I think he got to China, to Russia because the Chinese basically rolled him out of there. They didn't want that problem. And I think Assange took him through Russia. He has close ties with Russia. And I think the Russians were happy to have him there, for the 21 hours that he was supposed to be there. Originally, that was the length of his original layover, so they could, vacuum up his information and, have him get out of there. I think they saw it as a very low-cost opportunity to stick it to the Americans and get some valuable intelligence. Then the Americans revoked his passport. They, Ecuador, who was supposed to take him in, gets a call from Joe Biden and immediately says, we don't want Snowden. And every other country that Snowden starts applying to says, we're not going to give him asylum. Then American allies in Europe force the plane of the Bolivian president to land. He was coming from Moscow, going back to Bolivia. And they were afraid that Snowden was stowed away on the plane. They forced it to land in Austria. And once that happened, that was it. Like, Snowden was stuck in Russia. He couldn't, if the U.S. was ready to ground planes because they thought Snowden was in them, the Russians can't, they see themselves as a superpower still, and there's no way they can let this guy out and then have him be snatched up by the Americans and, tortured and put to death, which was the trope inside Russia of what would happen to him. No self-respecting superpower does that. Just like, if the situation were reversed and we had Edward Snowdenovich from Russia, we wouldn't let him go. We wouldn't send him back to Russia. We wouldn't let him leave America if we thought there was a risk that that the Russians would grab him the second he was outside of our borders. I think it's the Obama administration kind of messed this up by ratcheting up its public rhetoric, but also boxing Putin in and leaving him no option. I think
if they had taken the route of,
you know, quietly doing this in the back corridors, I think it may have had a different outcome.
Because this becomes a loss of face, I guess, for Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, I mean, there was just too much machismo, I guess, on both sides to really have any movement at that point.
It's not just machismo. I mean, think about what it looks like inside of Russia. The Russian press immediately seized on Snowden and started making a hero out of him, you know, saying that he was a whistleblower and he's revealing all these evil American practices, you know, and ignoring the fact that whistleblowers in Russia are routinely killed and harassed and Russia, for all of the people who die in its jails, does not have the death penalty. And this is something that's a huge kind of propaganda tool inside Russia. Is like, oh, you know, America, you're lecturing us on human rights, but you guys have capital punishment and we don't. So don't lecture us. You know, just like we're afraid to send people back from Guantanamo Bay who are not the nicest people, we're afraid to send them back to countries where they might be tortured. So, this isn't just posturing on Russia's side or America's side. I think these are real concerns. Also, keep in mind, the weapons trafficker, Victor Boot, who was snatched up by American agents in Thailand and then put on trial and convicted in New York, before he was put on trial and throughout the trial, the Russians were demanding his extradition because he was a Russian citizen. They said, we'll deal with it. Now, whether they would actually deal with it or just let him out is a different story because he seemed to have connections at the highest levels of the Russian government. But the U.S. staunchly refused, and the Russians were extremely angry at that. And that was quite recent. That was just a couple years ago. So why would the Russians now suddenly turn turn Snowden over? Sorry about that.
That's okay. leaving aside, I'm not sure I agree with your assessment about Guantanamo Bay, but the concerns in terms of letting people out, if their concern was that they're going to be tortured, but let's leave that aside.
I'm not saying that's the only concern. I'm saying that's part of the calculus.
Lastly, let me ask you this. If it is one of those situations where it became just too high profile and the positions were just too easily hardened, if I'm Edward Snowden, am I concerned that in 18 months, 36 months, 48 months, whenever this starts to die down, that at one point I'm going to be quietly sent, kicked out of the country and basically left for the Americans to pick up? I mean, at one point, right, this dies down.
Yeah, I mean, this is also, look, we talked about Russian short-term thinking. They gave him a year's asylum. What is that? I mean, that's just kicking the can down the road. In a year, it's going to, like, the same issue is this. It's going to be an issue again. It's going to be in the news again in both countries. They didn't really solve anything. And I'm sure Edward Snowden is pretty nervous guy right now. Plus, he's in a country he's in a city that's pretty brutal, and he doesn't speak the language. I'm sure people are tailing him and constantly coming to interview him. And he doesn't know what's going to happen in a year. And I don't think the Russians know either. I think they kind of tend to kick the can down the road and hope the can disappears. And this is what they did here.
Julia Iafi, thank you so much for your time today. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program wherein we will talk about this story. The editor-in-chief of The Guardian retells the story of how the British government basically came to The Guardian offices. They were not by surprise, and they took some computers down into the basement with apparently a sledgehammer and smash them. It is a wonderful parable about how it seems the government cannot really, has no means other than intimidation to which to deal with these issues. We will talk about that at length. We'll also talk about this Jeffrey Toobin piece, and also, I think, contrast it with a piece by Andrew Bacevich on Snowden. Grok Law has shut down. One more casualty of the NSA surveillance of the CIA cops to the coup in Iran 60 years ago. We will touch on Egypt. And, of course, Ted Cruz renouncing perhaps the only good part about him. That and more as we head in. I am looking at the count of members that Matt and Mike were able to get yesterday. And let me tally it up. Oh, it's zero. Even though they made such an effort yesterday to push for new members, zero. Now, I will... Oh, wait, there was a cancellation. Wow. You guys are really doing great on that accord. Folks, let's show Matt and Mike how you make an appeal for membership. And that is, we need your support. And there, I've said this to countless times, but if you can get better in-depth interviews on stories that obviously appeal to you, because I see you downloading it. I see you downloading the program. I know that sometimes you do it more on Fridays than you do other days, but for the most part, the vast majority of you are downloading multiple times a week. I can see you. I'm looking at you right now. And you got something right there. Right above, right on your lip, right there. Just wipe it like that. Please, folks, become a member today, majority.fm. Very simple to sign up. You have, when our app is rolled out in 2 weeks, you will have access to the past 200-plus shows at a press of the button on your phone. That enough should make you want to become a member today. You can also support this program by buying stuff. If you buy stuff from Amazon, buy it through our link. You will notice no difference. But we will get a little kickback. Go to majority.fm, scroll down, click on the link, bookmark it, buy your crap from there. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IM is on. We'll see you in the better half.